ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We're in the mountains in Europe, where there are forests and meadows, and a 27-kilometre tunnel that scientists shoot lasers in. It's CERN, and it costs billions to build, and it's just about to be brought to a halt by a bird with a baguette. I'm Dr. Anne Jones, and in my new series for What the Duck, I'm taking on nature's most wanted, the animals that end up on the wrong side of the law. Find What the Duck on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. In Australia, Indigenous incarceration rates are off the scale. So how can the justice system address the many complex underlying issues that give rise to criminal offending by First Nations people? For the last 4 years, the District Court of New South Wales has been trialling what's known as the Wollamer Sentencing List, a program aimed at reducing recidivism. Normally, a judge sitting behind an elevated bench sentences an offender, often to prison, and that's the end of the process. In contrast, participants in the Wollamer List stay out in the community on bail and in return must comply with a comprehensive case plan aimed at addressing their criminal behaviour. The plan can include regular drug and alcohol testing, culturally appropriate rehabilitation and designated housing. Once a month, participants come back to court and have a frank conversation about how they're travelling and how to get the support they need to stay on track. Those conversations take place at a round table and are aimed at helping the participants address their traumas, access their Indigenous spirituality and connect with loved ones and community. I'm joined by Emma Hudson-Bugajia, a Wiradjuri woman. Emma is a lawyer with the New South Wales Aboriginal Legal Service, and also by Auntie Barbara O'Neill, a Dangati and Wailwan woman. She's a Wollamer List elder. She's a counsellor and an expert in intergenerational trauma. Barbara, what does the word Wollamer mean?
The word Wollamer is a Darug word that means coming back.
And so the idea being coming back to what, your identity, your community, your culture, a healthy crime-free life? What do you mean by
absolutely every one of those? A lot of the time, the participants, through the trajectory of their journey, self-exile from community and family, and the Wollamer List digs in and drills down with them and shows them that culture is within their own body, their own soul, and as far as they want to run from it, they can't. And we help them to see that culture is actually the foundation stone for Aboriginal people going forward.
The over-incarceration rates around Australia are astronomical. I think it's something like Indigenous people, First Nations people are 3% of the population in New South Wales, but they're 25% of the male prison population, 34% of the female prison population. And critically for this conversation, 55% of offenders re-offend within 12 months. So we have a national crisis here. Emma, tell me, who is eligible to participate in the Wollamer List, this kind of different new approach to sentencing people?
Yeah, so the Wollamer List is in the district court. So your matter has to be in the district court. It is a sentencing court. So that means that the clients are pleading guilty to serious offending that comes to the district court. You have to plead guilty to become eligible for the Wollamer List. Not only that, there has to be an agreed signed statement of facts on sentence, and the client has to consent for their matters to come into the Wollamer List. Importantly, you also have to identify as First Nations and be accepted by the relevant community as well. So all of those things make you eligible for the Wollamer List. There's some particular offences that are not eligible and they just remain in the general list.
That's things like murder, manslaughter, sexual assault, those sorts of things.
Yes, all of them, some of the domestic violence, some of the time they can come into this program as well.
How does it work? There are a number of different stages to this process. There's something called a sentencing conversation, then there's a case plan created, and then what, you come back regularly and talk to the court? How does it actually work?
So it's a round circle table with the judge present, the elders or respected people, and support people. They've got the DPP solicitor there, and they've got support people from custody, if the participant's in custody, or support people from the community. There's community corrections officer who's been working with the client for a while, and justice, health, or drug and alcohol supports are also there. So there's a wide range of supports in the courtroom, which you don't usually see in the general list. And that's what makes the Wollamer list so holistically important, I guess, to the clients, because all those services are in one spot. After the introductory conversation, it's then adjourned for a case plan conversation. And that's when everything that's kind of said in the introductory conversation, everything that the participant raises in court or with their solicitor, so me, is formulated into a case plan where people are held accountable for their actions, the client's held accountable for their actions, and then we work off that case plan each month, comes back to court, and each month it's reviewed until about 12 months, and then the client gets sentenced.
You might be in a conventional courtroom, but rather than having the judge sitting behind the elevated bench and all the rest of it, you're actually all sitting around a table and you're talking through what the needs of the offender are. And then the participants come back regularly to talk to all these people about and to report on their progress about once a month. I'm really, really interested. What's the role of the elder and respected person, Barbara? Because that's your role, isn't it, Auntie Barbara?
Yes, it is. Okay, so our role is to work with the judge. And we do have nothing to do with sentencing or anything legal. And we often will have private conversations with the judge about how we think the participant is going before and after their particular conversation. We will offer, from a cultural perspective, what we think is driving the repeat offending, or maybe the participant's come in that day and is really doesn't want to be there, but goes there because they need to be there. That's not all the time, but some of them are. So if it's like that, we will discuss with the judge in private why we think they've been reluctant that day. And then we listen very carefully to what the defence has to say about the month that's just gone. And then we also listen to the prosecutor when they speak to the participant, and sometimes we will take up what the prosecutor said and deliver it in another way without seeming like we're repeating some of the things the prosecutor said. We'll do it in a culturally sensitive way without apportioning shame or blame. And then we will ask, say Emma, we will ask her a clarification, or we may ask Emma, can she enlighten us on something else if the participant's not well that day? Look, it's really hard on the Wollamer list for a participant. So sometimes they just don't want to talk in front of so many people. And we also receive documents before court starts. So I get a bunch of documents that I read through the weekend before, and I drill down into those documents to see if I can pick up things that come from a cultural perspective that may be missed by non-Aboriginal people.
And what sorts of things do you pick up?
The community corrections officer might say something like, oh yes, they had a visit back to country, and then they'll say something like, but they wanted to come back a day early, something like that. So I would suddenly jump on to they wanted to come back a day early. And I'd be thinking to myself, why did they want to come back a day early? And so therefore, you can safely make an assumption that something's gone wrong in community or family, And sometimes that's been going on since they were young and has informed a lot of their behaviours.
The case plan, which is created at the beginning of the process, it might focus on issues like housing or drug and alcohol rehab. It explores the underlying issues giving rise to offending behaviour. What happens? I mean, the participant comes back every month. What happens if, say, they've failed a drug and alcohol test, or, I don't know, they might have moved away from accommodation, or there might be behaviours which are not consistent with the agreed case plan? What do you do?
For example, if someone has had long-term accommodation and for some reason they've had to move out of that accommodation, it's part of their bail, but it's also part of their case plan. What do we do? So usually I inform the DPP. We go before the judge, which is just the participant, the DPP and the judge. So a lot of these matters happen outside of the Wollamer list. If the bail is varied, then it's just dealt with in the court then. But when we do come back to the Wollamer list, that is written in the updated case plan, what's happened, why it's happened. The elders get that information beforehand, and then the judge gets that information as well. And we all talk about it and how it happened, why it happened, what kind of accountability can be made. And then the elders give their insights, which are usually really helpful to the participants, considering it's not this colonial system, it's elders from your community or from communities you know, trying to work with you as a participant to break down what's really going on.
Barbara, tell me about the people that you've kind of worked with who've come through the Wollamer list and what you've been able to tell the court about them and their experience, given your expertise in as a counsellor and as with an expert in trauma and intergenerational trauma. Tell me about some of the things.
In a mainstream court, it's assumed that everyone has the same, is the same, thinks the same, has culturally the same in a way. But in this court, you're looking at the Aboriginal experience. You're looking at transgenerational trauma. You're looking at the fallout of genocide. It's almost like this court is the justice system's reparation towards what the justice system's role was historically in Aboriginal lives. So it's like a reparation. It's very healing for someone to have someone there that gets it. That's just such a relief. They don't feel so othered in the world if someone else gets it.
As opposed to being in a conventional courtroom where, like we were talking about before, the judge sits behind an elevated bench and you're sitting behind your defence lawyer, you're all sitting at a round table and there's somebody who is a respected elder, a First Nations elder, who's sitting there talking to you and has some kind of lived experience.
Yes, and also who can talk to their spirit. It's very important for us. And many of the participants really love that someone can talk to their spirit self, to their deeper self. And that's what all the participants intuitively are protecting.
I understand there was a woman participant who had accommodation issues. Can you tell me about her?
There was a woman and she was a recidivist and she really, 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 really wanted to live in community. Anyway, she went to a highly respected place when she was given bail and it was...
Accommodation,
yes. And it was supporting her in getting back into community and learning how to get back into community. But she just couldn't settle. She just kept leaving the premises and sitting in parks and things like that. And when I spoke to her, I realised that she'd been in Parramatta Girls' Home and... Or was it Parramatta? It might have been too. Anyway, she was in a place where it was quite heavy. And the building that she was staying in was built around the same time, the same style of architecture as the girls' home that she was in. And when I discussed that with her, we realised that her terrors, her night terrors, were coming from the exact same windows, the exact placing of the doors, the arched doorways. And we're able to discuss that and have her moved into a completely different type of architecture, and that's architecture's role in trauma.
A really interesting example of actually you being there to be able to listen to people and maybe elicit something that a normal courtroom situation couldn't.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the elders and respected people that sit on the Wollama list are integral to what the Wollama list is trying to achieve. I think that Arnie Barb and a lot of the other elders that sit on the list put their heart and soul into the Wollama list, and it really shows through the clients how much culture means to them and how much having culture in a courtroom shows good results, but it also shows that the clients can, I guess, have that connection in a formal setting as well, which has been missing in the criminal justice system. I think what particularly is missing is strength-based in the criminal justice system in a conventional court, and that is really important in the Wollama list, to have your clients have their voice and the clients have an understanding from parties at the table that their offence is not their whole being. They have a lot of different strengths to draw on, and the elders and the respected people see that very quickly and are able to bring that out in the client. So they're confident in speaking to the court, but also confident in telling their story as well, which is really important.
And to work with the other people around the table to get another option, because you have caseworkers and corrections people there who might be able to come up with solutions for that,
yes,
for that
absolutely.
Issue. You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. Today we're talking about a program that's tackling recidivism among First Nations people who come before the New South Wales District Court. Barbara O'Neill, tell me about some of the issues facing clients that affect their ability to comply with a case plan.
There was a woman, and she just thought that jail was it. It was just the way it was, and she didn't think much about that she'd have a chance, even on the Wollama list. So she came onto the Wollama list, and she was very, very honest and very straightforward. And her parents came to the first conversation, and then she said after that she didn't want them there. So then she was doing really well, and she got out on bail and she stayed with mum first. It was really hard, so she stayed with dad, and that became really hard. And then it was her last conversation before she was going to graduate from Wollama. And I don't know why I said it. I don't know why. It had nothing to do with anything. But I said to her, I said, you know, you've got to stop carrying your family, not children of her own, but her family, right? I said, you've got to stop carrying your family and think about yourself while you're out, now that you've got this big chance. I said, because, you know, you have to think of yourself. And I said to her, selfish is such a misused or misdescribed word. It means self-ish. You've got to think of yourself sometimes. Anyway, there was dead silence. And at the time I came in on AVL.
Audiovisual link.
Yeah. Yep. And one of my skills is being in the room and being able to read the participant, but it's really hard on audiovisual. Anyway, and she went really quiet. And she didn't speak for a couple of minutes, and I thought, I've really insulted her because she really loves her family. And she just went quiet and she looked at me and she said, you know what? She said, on my way here, I thought, I've got to cut the family for a while. I have to move away from them. I have to do my own thing. And she said, hearing an elder suggest that has given me so much power. And so that's another case of just being able to understand what is bothering that participant, because we are given the freedom as Aboriginal elders in that court to really work the way we need to work. We're not constrained. And one of the major things I do anyway is if I think there's been a conversation between the prosecution and the participant, and I think the participant hasn't articulated properly what they mean, I will very casually bring that conversation up with them there and then, and elicit from them the answer they really want to give. Then that answer ends up on the transcript, and that transcript is used in their final sentencing. So I really try and work that their thoughts are elicited so that their absolute integral thoughts are down on paper.
It's really interesting because this can sound all very kind of intuitive and a bit woo-woo, but in fact, maybe what you're doing is actually kind of picking up on cultural cues and an understanding of the lived experience that maybe the other people in the room don't have.
I'm not saying that they don't have it. They may not have had the chance to develop it or work with it, but I can tell you now that people that come to Wollamar to work there, they might think it's a bit woo-woo when they start. But by the time they've finished there, they have a deep respect for how we work. We work on a spiritual level quite a bit. And it's that spiritual level that we have to have the courage to sit in a court where everything's factual. And we have to have the courage to speak about spiritual issues that to people just walking into that room would think that we were running a cult or we're running some sort of guru program. But, you know, the Aboriginal people who are the participants, they know what we're talking about.
Presumably there are also participants who have a lot of bravado, who think this Wollamar list is a way of staying out of prison and they can pull the wool over your eyes.
So there was this, he was a bit brash, this young man, and it was like, oh yeah, I'm into Wollamar, I'm going to get out of this really fast. And I hadn't said much. I was just looking at him and it was nearly towards the end. And I said to him, because he was deflecting all of our help, all of our insight, he was deflecting it. I said, it's really important that you get some counselling. I said, you're not going to move away. And but this is now trauma counselling. I said, you're not going to move away from the juvenile way that you act until you've sorted that out. Because the juvenile way he acted was getting him into trouble inside, right? All of the bravado dropped. And anyway, so evidently he said to his solicitor down in the cells, who the hell is that? Where'd you get her from? And it's that kind of, oh, I don't know, energy that when you really, really put your heart, as Emma says, we put our heart and soul into it. Sometimes when I'm talking to a participant, there's no one else in the room is, seemingly to me, there's no one else in the room.
How often do people successfully go through the Wollamar list, and how often are the obstacles too big and people don't comply with their case plan and you need to go back to the kind of conventional court system? How often does that happen?
I think it happens more often than not that people are completing the Wollamar list. It is difficult. As Aunty Barb was saying, it's very challenging to face a lot of these things in an open court and also have a lot of people talking with you at the table, but also talking about your past as well. I think that's really overwhelming. But in terms of people finishing or the participants finishing the Wollamar list, there's an overwhelming sense that that propels you forward into the graduation and sentencing. And on the other hand, some people are just not ready at that time to proceed through the program.
Barbara?
Oh, absolutely. The time frame's different for all of them. Everyone's an individual story, yeah.
You've also worked, Barbara, with people who haven't been successful. Can you tell me about some of those people?
It's really interesting because there was one young man, he'd been out on bail, but, you know, like we could tell he was getting dangerously close to reoffending. And he thought that the Wollamar list was just a pathway out of prison, an easy way out. And when I spoke to him, I could feel that he had no interest in what the Wollamar list had to offer, absolutely no interest in the cultural side of it. And it's very hard too because we're working with different generations of people with all different ways that their generation molds them. But I don't think that he's going to finish. I really don't. I think he'll be asking for sentencing rather than finishing. We did have one and he was... He tried so hard. He tried everything and he just couldn't do it, could not do it. And I know for a fact that he really needs intensive, absolutely intensive trauma support. He needs trauma counselling, trauma support. But it's just the intrusive thoughts, and then he goes out and looks for drugs to stop the intrusive thoughts from his childhood assaults. He's a product of juvenile justice, of juvenile institutions. So it's just like 85%, I would say 85% of participants have all got histories of childhood sexual assault.
That's an extraordinary figure.
Yeah, isn't it? Yep. Yeah.
This program's a pilot scheme. It's been going since 2022. What do you hope it will grow into in the future?
The pilot is an important first step, but what would really make an impact, I think, is for the Wollumi Court to be legislated or permanent, as well as expanded to more locations. I think it is great that it is within the city, but it only allows for a few different areas for clients to be referred into the Wollumi list. And I think
only 50 participants at a time, right?
Yeah, only 50 participants at a time. I think if it's legislated then and funded, then it would be great to be able to expand that number, because clearly people who come through the Wollumi list are benefiting from this trauma-informed, problem-solving approach to sentencing, especially with the cultural foundations from the elders and the insights that they bring with their cultural knowledge as well.
And do other parts of the country already have a kind of a more comprehensive system like this?
Not that I understand in the district court. I know that there's Youth Quarry Court, which was established in Parramatta and now is in Surry Hills Children's Court and also Dubbo Children's Court. That's what I know in New South Wales, and I think in other parts of the country that there are probably in Victoria more established therapeutic courts such as this that we could probably or definitely should take a look at and see how they've been legislated and how they incorporate cultural connection as well.
So Victorian Koori Court would seem to be a model that you'd want to emulate.
Or even the New South Wales Koori Court. I think in terms of that, it's been proven to be successful by reducing imprisonment without any impact on reoffending rates.
Very quickly, Barbara, a last word from you.
I just see Wollumi as a perfect example of decolonising the justice system, the court system. I love it as a vehicle for Aboriginal participants to share more than their offending. They share their hopes, their dreams, and they share their spiritual lives. And I think that's really, really important. They're heard and they're seen. And I'd love to see this in every court in New South Wales.
Arnie Barbara O'Neill and Emma Hudson Bohagia, thank you both for speaking to the Law Report. It's been a really illuminating conversation for me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Damien.
That's all we've got time for this week. Do follow the Law Report on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and to audio producer Elise Simons. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.